Chairman, members of the Commission, for the record, my name is Bill Robinson, Chief of Fisheries Enforcement. At the August 25, 2005 Commission meeting, amendments were adopted that created a definition of a sack for measuring oyster taken from Texas waters. The second part of this action was intended to reduce the commercial daily bag limit for oysters to preserve and stabilize the economic value of oysters taken during the open season. However, the language published in the Texas Register only changed the amount of oysters that may be in possession on board a commercial oyster vessel and did not make it clear that the 90 sacks was intended to be a daily limit as well. The proposed amendment would correct that error and clarify that the daily bag limit for commercial oyster fishermen is 90 sacks and the daily bag limit for recreational fishermen is 2 bushels, which is equal to 2 sacks. This amendment would also change the recreational limit units from bushels to sacks to remove the possibility of confusion in the fishery that could result from using different units to measure take. Currently, not more than 90 sacks of culled oysters may be on board a licensed commercial oyster boat. This proposal would clarify that the legal one-day limit is 90 sacks of culled oysters of legal size. The amendment would also clarify the recreational possession limit and allow a person to take in one day or possess not more than 2 sacks of legal-sized oysters. This concludes my presentation. I would be glad to answer any questions, and the staff recommendation recommends the Texas Parks and Wildlife Commission adopt the following motion. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Bill. Any questions? Motion by Bivens, second by Friedkin. All in favor, aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, motion passes. Thanks for your work.
Thanks,
on
sir.
That, Bill. Next up, a briefing item on the 2006 Share Lunker program. Phil?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Phil DeRocher. I'm Director of Inland Fisheries. Before I start this presentation, I'd like to commend Colonel Flores and the game wardens for all the excellent work they did at Falcon Lake. It's an issue that we've been trying to deal with for at least 20 years that I've been here, and I think we finally found a formula that may bring them to the table, may bring the Mexicans to the table with us so we can find a solution to this. So thank you all so much, Chris and Pete, for all your efforts. I'm going to spend a few minutes this morning talking to you about one of the most successful programs, I think, ever that we've ever established in our division, and may be one of the most successful of anybody in the agency, the Share Lunker program. Now, to kind of give you some idea where we're going with this, the Share Lunker mission is to involve the public in the conservation and enhancement of trophy bass fishing in Texas. I know a lot of you commissioners are fairly new, so from a historical perspective, the Share Lunker program started in 1986. It was called Operation Share Lone Star Lunker. At that time, it was sponsored by Lone Star Brewery. In 1993, we changed sponsors. Anheuser-Busch got involved, and the program at that time was called Share Lunker. And we got significant sponsorship from Anheuser-Busch at that time. And in 1996, it was changed to the Budweiser Share Lunker program. Over the years, because of the generosity of Anheuser-Busch, we have quite an endowment built up for this program, and it's used to fund it, and we've been able to get a lot of equipment and things that we need to move forward with this program. The rules of the program are quite simple, just to kind of give you some background. A person must legally catch a largemouth bass greater than 13 pounds in Texas waters. It can be the public or private. The program runs from October 1 to April 30th of each year. And that was changed several years ago. Initially, the program ran from December 1 to April 30th. We require that the fish be kept in good condition. We must expect the fish to survive. Our biologists will make a judgment on that when they get to the fish, see whether they think it's worth us taking the fish and whether we're going to be able to keep it alive. The possession of the fish must be transferred to the Parks and Wildlife within 12 hours of capture. Sometimes that's a little bit of a challenge, especially lately. We've been getting a lot of fish out of Allen Henry in far west Texas, and sometimes it's hard to get there in 12 hours. Our department will return the fish to the angler after we've identified the genetics of it, and we've tried to spawn it, or at the conclusion of the season. And we have the option of keeping the fish for an indefinite length of time if we think it's a real special fish and there's some things that we need to do with it. Now, what does the angler get for this? There's a season-ending banquet, and that's going to be held next Saturday at TFFC. Each angler who submits a fish gets a replica of that fish. They get a Lone Star jacket. They have an opportunity to win some rods and reels. The angler who catches the largest fish in any year becomes the angler of the year. He gets a replica. He gets everything everybody else gets. And he also, if he's a Texas resident, he gets a lifetime fishing license. And more importantly, if he wins this award, he gets to have his picture taken with me at the event. We had four goals in the program when we started. The first goal, of course, was to promote fishing and the bass fishery in Texas. And, you know, we're very fortunate. It's like the stars were lined up when this program started. We were initially set to begin this program in December 1 of 1986. Well, on November 26, Mark Stevenson caught probably the most famous bass ever caught in Texas, Ethel, from Lake Fork. And we got a call and said, would y'all want to start the program a few days early? Somebody made a good decision. I think you know the history of this fish. This fish was put on display at Bass Pro Shop in Springfield. And I think over a 3 or 4 year period, they estimated about 5 million people came to Springfield just to see Ethel. When Ethel passed, the major networks carried the funeral. You know, and it was a huge success promotion of our programs. All the major TV networks covered the story on the first entry into the program. One of the ways we measure our success is we look at how much publicity we're giving to our sponsors in the more traditional type of fishing magazines, Field and Stream, and the outdoor pages of the major newspapers in Texas. And we estimated that in 2005, we had over 2,540 column inches of press that we got for the program. And we estimated a value of that of over $300,000. But there's also something else that happened. We've got our story told in a lot of non-traditional places where you don't usually see fishing. We've had articles in the Wall Street Journal and in Forbes. And what's important to us here in Texas is that the program has got national recognition. We've got people coming from all over the country trying to catch these lunkers. We have anglers from 19 different states that have contributed 71 of these shared lunkers to the program. So people know about it. The second goal of the program was to promote catch and release of large fish. About the time, well, the same year we started this program, we were doing a lot of work with restrictive regulations in Texas. 1986 was when we put the statewide limit on. We had a lot of work going on with slot limits. But all of those regulations were protecting the smaller fish, basically. We had no biological reason to limit the catch of the big fish. It wasn't a resource issue. But we realized how important those big fish were. And one of the things we wanted to do with this program was to promote the catch and release of big fish. And I think it's been very successful. This is a very unique fish here. This is share lunker number 389. It was caught at Lake Allen Henry in the 2005 season and brought back to the lake and released by the angler. It has also become share lunker number 423 because the fish was caught again this year by another angler. So it shows that catch and release for these big fish does work. One of the other goals was to gather information on big fish. We're not very good at sampling fish of this size. We very seldom see them. And you can see by this chart, over the years, we've been able to have in our hands 423 of these large fish to do work on. The best year was in 1996 when we had 36 fish. The worst year was in 2001. That was at the peak of the largemouth bass virus. I don't think it was killing the fish. I think what it was doing was making the fish sick, and they were getting a little harder to catch. We had an excellent year this year. We had 32 entries in the program, which is the third highest we've ever had in the history of the program. To give you some idea how important this program is and how it's grown and how it's matured, you got to remember that prior to February of 80, the state record in Texas was 13.5 pounds. It was caught in Lake Medina in 1943. That record had stood for that time. In 2006, we had 423 fish larger than that have been caught out of 54 reservoirs in the state and 13 private lakes. And we think this is important because what it's saying is there you have an opportunity to catch one of these fish anywhere in the state. It's not a Northeast Texas deal. We've made bass fishing, trophy bass fishing, a statewide thing in Texas, and we're very proud of that. Of course, Lake Fork is 228 of the total 423 fish came from Lake Fork. Second is Allen Henry. This is a really neat little lake that's just kind of blossomed in the last 5 or 6 years, and it's the second most number of lunkers at 23, and of course Sam Rayburn has 22 over the history of the program. And the fourth goal we had was to improve the genetics of our brood stock so that we would be producing a fish that grew faster, and we wanted to use these large fish. Obviously, there was something special about them if they got to that size. And we're just now beginning to, we have the equipment now, we have the facility at the Freshwater Fishery Center to begin this work, and we're in it really big time. We've had some preliminary success, I believe, with getting these fish to survive, and now it's going to take time for us to evaluate the performance of these fish. So we're really excited. We think this program has met all the goals that it was set out to. We're not quite done with the breeding yet, but we think we're well on the way. This year was special, because this year we had a special promotion for the 400 entry into the program. And we have a little video that was produced on this catch, and I'd like you to take a look at it.
Working beneath these waters for something so big, it's the Kansas resident Jason Baird's mini in headlines.
Spent about 45 minutes trying to fish it, and finally hooked it and got it in, and happened to weigh 13.1 pounds. So it was kind of a cool experience.
This is a 13-pound Florida largemouth bass, but it's not just for size that matters for Jason. It's the timing of his catch.
I've heard about that, like on the ESPN Bass Center, they talk about it quite a bit, and they were talking about 398, but really didn't register to me that, you know, 400 was worth a lot of money and, you know, a lot of great juice, basically.
Jason's fish is the 400th one that he caught and donated to the Budweiser Share Lunker program since the program began 20 years ago. The donated fish are used for research and hatchery production to restock Texas lakes. In exchange, the Shearmonger program provides a fiberglass replica of your catch, and in Jason's case, a $5,300 cash prize and a specialty rod and reel.
Our fish, they don't stock bass, they don't do some of the habitat projects and stuff like that that Texas does, so I think, you know, a lot of states, especially Kansas, when they live here, can take a look at what Texas. Maybe copy it or do something the same.
After a 400-plus mile journey from Lake Amistad to Athens, Share Lunker number 400 rests happily in her new home at the Texas Freshwater Fishery Center in East Texas.
It just occurs to me that the largemouth bass fishing in Texas is the best in the world, in there, at least among the best anyway. And that shows that our fishery management people have been working at it a long time. So we play fishers 8, 9, 10, 11 years
to get this file. For Texas Parks and Wildlife, this is Daniel Saldana. Thank you. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Well done.
So, yes, sir. They're not doing a whole lot. As far as I know, you know, they are...
There's a press release for you, Lydia.
they have the Florida bass. The Florida bass are there. We have some challenges here that they don't have in Florida. You know, the native fish, or the so-called native fish, the fish that were brought into Texas from all over the United States in the 40s, were northern bass. And we're constantly fighting this crossbreeding of these fish. That's one of the advantages that California has over us. California didn't have any bass until they brought the Florida bass there, and that's all they have. So they don't have that competition with the northern bass. Their water's a little colder. The fish live longer. But those are all challenges that we're facing, and we're going to work our way through it.
What are the...
What do the genetic studies tell us about the genetics of these fish, of the Lunkers 13,000 over?
They're predominantly pure Florida bass. We do find some small level of integrates in some of the fish, and we return those to the lake. We're focusing on the pure Florida bass because history tells us that that is the fish with the greatest size potential, and that's what we're focusing on.
And one other question, golden algae, the algae blooms, how have those affected the reservoirs in which Lunkers have been found?
We didn't have any Lunkers from any reservoirs with golden algae in them. Of course, we didn't have any before golden algae got some of these lakes. Golden algae is a problem. It's a serious problem. Everything west of I-35. We're working real hard, spending a lot of money on it, and we don't have a magic. We don't have a bullet yet, silver bullet.
Phil, they said on the on that little video that some of these Lunkers are 10 to 12 years old. Do you have any data on how long they actually will live?
Yes, sir. We age every one of these fish. And I think the Lunkers run, the ones that we get in, run anywhere from 8 to probably 12. I think the oldest bass that anybody's ever recorded, I think, was 17 years, something, 15 to 17 years. So life expectancy of these fish, if we get real lucky, will be 11 and 12 years old. You know, it's not magic to raise a big fish. You have to have a fish that gets big. And that's what we're doing with the genetics in the Florida bass. You got to have habitat. We have that in Texas. And they got to live long enough. And that's what we try to do with our regulations. Thank you, sir.
Yes, I happen to be at the... 2 weeks ago, I went to the Athens Freshwater Center, and it's really amazing the state-of-the-art and the technology that that you all are implementing to I guess, lime breed bass here for Texas. And in particular, I was impressed how you're doing DNA testing to identify, I guess, certain markers for size or whatever. But it's really it'd be an experience for anyone to go up. It's very educational, and it's a first-class job. So, again, Phil, I commend you and encourage any of you that have not been there, you really should go there. It's a very, very impressive facility.
Thanks for that. Goes to our partners, Anheuser-Busch, the sponsor of this, because a lot of the equipment that we're using was really something that wouldn't have fit in our budget if we wouldn't have had that support from Anheuser-Busch.
What kind of impressed me, they have a separate little tub or aquarium for each one of these share Lunkers, and then their eggs are placed in another specific bat, and then from there they're moved. But it's a very sophisticated breeding system, just like I guess you would breed horses or cattle. And I commend you for that.
You want to give a little plug for June 3rd?
June the 3rd is that's next Saturday is when we're having the Lunker banquet. And also in conjunction with that, we have two gentlemen being entered into our Hall of Fame, Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame, Mr. Bradley and Dick Hart, I think a lot of you know. So we're excited about that. It's going to be a big night. We have 30. If everybody shows up, we'll have 32 fishermen coming to get a replica. So it's going to be good. And would love to have you there.
There wouldn't be any place to hold it if it weren't for Dick Hart.
We're going to hold it in the tent again this year. Yeah. Hopefully this will be our last year in the tent.
Yeah. Phil, you tell me if appropriate. It might be nice for the commission or the chairman to send Dick Hart a note of thanks. He has really been an incredible champion for the banquet, which is
we just did that for the
great
banquet.
Okay. Yeah, we'll let him know how much we appreciate him. Yeah. Good work on that's an exciting program.
And this is another reason why we're so excited about Dan and my Texas Bass Classic that we're looking forward to next year, because we definitely have the legs in the state, and we just need to showcase them and tell the rest of the world what we have here.
We appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Next up, action item number 10, Public Lands Proclamation, Mike Berger.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. I'm Mike Berger. For the record, Director of the Wildlife Division. Today I'm going to brief you on the proposed changes to regulations.
I'm sorry. Hold on. Oh, sorry. Whoops. I did. Sorry, Mike. I did skip Ann. Sorry, Ann. Designation of TPWD. biological advisory team. That person might have wished I had skipped this, right?
As I've been telling folks, it'll take probably longer to read the item than to present it. I'm Ann Bright, General Counsel. Chapter 83 of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Code calls for some criteria and some requirements regarding the development of regional habitat conservation plans. And basically, these are plans that certain governmental bodies are required to do in order to get certain federal permits. And this statute imposes some additional requirements, including the formation of a citizens advisory committee and a biological advisory team. And both of these committees have representatives from the Parks and Wildlife Department that are designated by the commission. There are two that we're here today on. One is the Barton Springs Edwards Aquifer Conservation District, and the other one is Williamson County. And both of these entities are looking to form or to prepare regional habitat conservation plans. In previous commission actions, this commission appointed Dwayne Schlitter to both of these, to citizens advisory committees and biological advisory teams associated with these. We'd like to now change that to Matt Wagner. And although I don't expect you to be able to read this, this is in your materials. This is the resolution that we are asking you to sign, and this is the recommended motion, which would really just replace Dwayne Schlitter with Matt Wagner on the team.
What does Matt do? I mean, I always like Matt.
He's here if you want to talk to him. We like
sorry, Matt. It's out of my hands, it looks like. Do you have a motion? Moved by Holmes, second by Brown. All in favor, aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, motion passes. Thanks, Ann. Now we're ready, Mike. Public lands.
Hi, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. I'm Mike Berger, the Director of the Wildlife Division. I'm going to talk today about proposed changes to the regulations governing public hunting lands. And to discuss the candidate state park hunts for the upcoming season and to open the season on public hunting lands for the upcoming season. We're recommending to remove the Aquila Wildlife Management Area from the public hunting program. The Corps of Engineers is not making it available for public hunting. Comments on that were 2 people in favor and 9 people opposed who wanted to continue hunting that area under our program. The second recommendation is to rename Matagorda Island from State Park to Wildlife Management Area. That changed authority earlier in this fiscal year, and it no longer functions as a state park, so it will be renamed to Wildlife Management Area. There were no public comments on that proposal. The third is to remove regulations addressing recreational activities and camping from Section 65192 and to create a new section to deal specifically with recreational activities on wildlife management areas. In regard to that, it kind of falls into 2 parts. And the first part, this was to remove those recreational activities and camping sections. There were no comments in favor, 4 opposed, because they wanted to, we believe, continue camping on those areas. Of course, that authority would be moved to the new section that would deal specifically with recreational activities on wildlife management areas. And with regard to that proposal, there were 2 people in favor and 8 opposed, and the 8 opposed indicated that they wanted hunting only to be the only areas on the wildlife management areas. And, of course, we would like to be able to offer the full spectrum of activities there. Also, we're recommending eliminating the waiver of fees for youth and disabled participation in events that are limited to youth or disabled persons for the purposes of research, education, or charity. And because there are no application or permit fees for such events, there are for hunting, but thus there is no need for such a waiver. And there were no comments on those proposals. Now moving to the candidate state parks for public hunting for this year, there are 42 state parks that are proposed for hunting in the upcoming season, and the list of those parks is in your hearing booklet. changes from last year are Matagorda Island coming out because it's now a wildlife management area instead of a state park. Lake Houston's in the process of a land transfer. Choke Canyon, at staff recommendation, is coming out, and Martin Dyes Jr. State Park is still suffering the damages from Hurricane Rita and would not be available. We would add two new state parks to hunting this year, which would be Abilene State Parks and Copper Break State Park. Hunt positions overall, state parks and wildlife management areas, are up 63 positions this year over last year, and youth hunting is up significantly by 244 positions this year from last year due to the creation of new youth categories. And also, in order to conduct the hunts on these lands, the commission is required to establish an open season for hunting on public lands each year. And this season would run from September 1st, 06 to August 31st of 07. So our staff recommendation is to adopt the amendments that we discussed, public comments first, and authorize the hunting activities designated in Exhibit B on areas of the state park system, and to authorize an open hunting season on public hunting lands.
Thank you, Mike. On the Corps of Engineers property?
Yes, sir.
Is there a trend where they're not allowing or encouraging public hunting on the properties that we operate?
I don't believe there is. There is, at that particular area, there's just been decreasing amounts of access to the areas, closing.
Okay, this is not a policy change on behalf of the
Corps. It's a policy change, just a matter on that particular area.
I don't think so, Mr. Chairman. This one has been a problem off and on through the years.
Any questions for Mike on the public lands proclamation? Anything we didn't cover yesterday? This action item, do I have a motion? By Friedkin, second by Parker. All in favor, aye. Any opposed? Any none? Motion passes. Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you.
Next up, we have a briefing, Panhandle Wildflowers, Reuben, Cantu, and Moki McCray. Oh, I'm sorry. Goodness gracious. I screwed up. Mr. Ellison, Ellis Gillen was signed up on item 10. I'm very sorry. Come on up, Mr. Gillen. My apologies. On the public lands proclamation, we'll have to take the vote again.
Hand up.
I got my stacks confused here. Sorry.
My name is Ellis Gillen. I'm speaking for myself. I'm speaking for an animal rights organization on the internet called Texas Animal. Before, and I might ask you again, will you please eliminate the Choke Canyon State Park from the list of hunting activities? The sports writers, if you, all the newspapers, magazines, what have you, if you go back to 1993, 4, 5, you'll find that they were writing about 12-point deer, 10-point deer, 8-point deer, et cetera, 220. Which were at Choke Canyon State Park. Today it looks like a moonscape. They've killed all those deer and there's nothing hardly left to hunt. So I think the hunt should be eliminated. In the event you do have the hunt, I'd like to ask the whole park not be closed for 9 years. The half the park was closed and half the park was open for the campers and bird watchers, fishers, everybody else. Last year, the whole park was taken over by the hunters for the whole week. And people with RVs and trailers and everything turned around the gate and went back home again because it was not publicized that the whole park was closed. The handout I've given you pertains to 65.192. I've underlined in yellow, I think. Quote, it says, quote, the executive director may permit recreational activities on public hunting lands compatible with sound resource management practices and public health and safety. I think that should read, the executive director shall permit recreational activities on public hunting lands to preclude the complete hunting of the taking over the park like we did last year. And the final thing I'd like to say, in the event you do not go back and research those original articles that Sasser and everybody else wrote, you're not going to believe what I tell you, that the park is like a moonscape. And I really think it's criminal. If I were a lawyer, I would take you to court because I think you're destroying state resources that belong to the public. I think it's a criminal act per the penal code, and you should be incarcerated, all of you. If you don't believe me, go down and look at the park and the destruction you've done. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gillen. Kirby Brown signed up on this also, I believe, Texas Wildlife Association, agenda item 10.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. My name is Kirby Brown, Executive Vice President of Texas Wildlife Association. We support the staff proposal to properly manage both wildlife and habitat on these parks. It's very important, very critical. We're gratified that by this commission's efforts and by the specific efforts of staff to increase the youth hunting component and our public hunting opportunities. We think that's great to see that continue to go up and make those available. And finally, let's fix a couple of those parks we had to knock out this time because we'd like to see more public opportunity out there to access the parks by the park users as well as public hunting opportunity. Thanks again. We appreciate it, sir.
Thank you, Kirby. Mike, could you address his point about the one or two parks that have been...
The Callahan unit, which is the more developed part of Choke Canyon, is now closed to hunting to take some pressure out of that developed area. The North Shore unit is still open to public hunting.
I think Kirby had a comment about a couple other parks that were not.
His comment was that he would like us to open more so that we could have more opportunity. We'll work on that.
Work on that.
Yes,
good.
Sir.
Thank you. Now, do I have a motion on item 10, Holmes, and second by Parker? All in favor? Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Thank you. All right. I apologize for getting off on that. Now, we've got the item 12, briefing Panhandle Wildfires. Before you start that, Ruben, I wanted to recognize our good friend David Allen from the Sand County Foundation that sponsored our Lone Star Land Stewards last night, and I know you've got to catch a plane, David, but thank you very much for all you did for the Lone Star Land Stewards. Appreciate it. From that to fire, another one of those Leopold tools. And there it is. Ruben?
Chairman Fitzsimmons, Commissioners, Mr. Cook, good morning. For the record, I'm Ruben Cantu, Regional Director for Wildlife Region 1, which encompasses the Trans-Pecos and the Panhandle. With me today is Major Ewell McCrary, Regional Commander in Lubbock. No doubt this winter has been a hot one, to say the least, in more ways than one. From December of 2005 through April, Texas has seen rangelands burning from north to south, east to west, all points in between, in various sizes of burns. The largest of these fires have occurred in the Texas Panhandle. The recent Panhandle fires that we're referring to as the Borger Fire or the I-40 fire, combined together referred to as East Amarillo Complex Fire. These complex fires have burned about a total of 907,000 acres, largest fires to date in the state of Texas. Fires are not over yet. We're just hearing right now of a fire taking place in the Caladura Canyon area. We don't have a lot of information yet as to the size of it, but we're hearing that it's somewhat considerable. At this time, I'd like to show you a brief video that our communication staff have put together. And I don't think there's any reason for any narration to go along with it. I think the video will speak for itself.
Chairman, Commissioners, Mr. Cook, for the record, my name is Mokey McCreary. I'm the regional major out of Lubbock. I have 65 counties, which includes the area that was burned. I'd like to brief you shortly on the law enforcement response to those fires. As Ruben said, it consumed just under 1 million acres. It comprised of 3 fires, and during that time, there was 11 people that lost their lives. Law enforcement responded to requests from various sheriff's offices and other emergency response agencies, such as fire departments. During that time, we had 8 game wardens that spent 137 hours, and we rescued 38 people. The fires were fanned by tremendous winds in March. Some of them were reported as high as 70 miles an hour. The fire itself was moving 50 miles an hour. One of my wardens, Wynn Bishop, helped evacuate an area called Jim Lake. It's a rural subdivision out of Border. He let them out single file through the fire. His statement to me was, it was almost impossible to see. I just knew where I was at. Now, just a quick note here. From the time that I started speaking, if we had been a mile away from the fire, it would have already taken us over. We couldn't have got out of the way of it. And same thing with Wynn. By the time he got those people out, the fire had actually moved past him, and he started checking other areas, houses. He found a burnt individual. He stayed with that individual until a coroner arrived. North of Wynn was Gary Barnes. Gary had come up to him to the car that just you previously saw in the slide. There was 2 women in that car. He loaded them up in his patrol vehicle, drove through the fire, and took them to safety. This scenario was played out over and over again several times. And again, as the wardens would work, the fire was moving so fast that it would go past them. Many of our wardens assisted in routing fire trucks because they knew the area and they had access to get into the properties. They helped cut fire breaks around homes. They warned the public of oncoming fires. They assisted in roadblocks, dispensed water and food, and again evacuated 38 people themselves. The soot in the air, the smoke was so thick that our air conditioners and our vehicles shut down. The cabin air filter just completely clogged up on many of them. But as I talked with several of the wardens, the biggest thing they said is thank you for good equipment. The four-wheel drive units that we had, good stuff. GPSs all aided in saving lives. Now, while this scenario was being played out, another drama was taking place. Wildlife was running for their lives, and the terrain was being changed. I would like to turn it back over to Ruben to explain those issues. Thank you.
Over the course of the last few minutes, y'all have seen a video and slides the damages caused by the wildfires in the Panhandle. And these fires have been extremely devastating to people, to homes, barns, fences, hay and grass fields, livestock, and yes, wildlife. Wildlife was impacted directly as well as indirectly. After viewing the video, folks may think that vegetation in the plains will never come back. It's going to need assistance. It's going to have to be reseeded. Now, even though the initial appearance is of a moonscape, let's not forget that many of these native plants in the Panhandle prairies evolved with fire. And those plants are alive. They will come back. A lot of these plants have mechanisms to cope with fire. They will grow new leaves. They'll resprout. They have seeds that will germinate because they were burned. These burned areas will come back, and what determines how quickly they will come back will be dependent on the kinds of plants that were affected, the intensity and duration of the fire, the precipitation before and after the fire, soil moisture conditions at the time of the fire, condition of the plants before the fire, and the management of the land after the fire. From a wildlife standpoint, yes, we lost some animals, but how many we don't know.
We know of small incidences of antelope caught in the corner of a fence that couldn't get through it, small groups of mule deer that were behind what they apparently thought were a protected side of a hill that were overcome, as well as individual reports of the individual animals of a deer or rabbits or turkey or whatever. These losses are to be expected, considering the magnitude and intensity of these fires. Our big concern right now is erosion. You saw in the video how the sand was blowing. A lot of people say all we need is a rainfall. Well, we don't need any hard, heavy rainfalls on country like that. Immediately after the fires, what we did lose, we lost many, many acres of nesting habitat for quail and turkey and some for lesser prairie chicken. We've also lost roosting cover, some of the big cottonwood trees for turkey. It won't be until the end of the growing season for us to fully evaluate our losses in wildlife habitat. And although the short-term effects seem bleak, over the long-term, this fire may prove very beneficial for wildlife and their habitat. There's going to be many favorable browse and forbs that will resprout and grow, and because they're going to be in a lower growth form, because they're going to be thinned out, there's going to be more available for deer and antelope. Additionally, burns will typically result in forbs responding first. Again, this is going to be a great food supply for big game, as well as also excellent seed producers for quail and turkey and lesser prairie chicken. Now, these fires are not something we wish for, but they do provide us an opportunity to study how landscape and wildlife responds to fires of this magnitude. Almost immediately after the fires, Wildlife Division staff began working with cooperating landowners to document the effects on these fires on vegetation and wildlife habitat. And staff has set up photo points on a number of ranches affected so that they may monitor and document over a long period of time the natural recovery of the wildlife habitat. I'd like to show you a few of these photo points to show you what we're talking about and what's taking place in the landscape over the lap from the end of the fires to the time some of these photos were taken, about a month and a half period. We're looking at what's referred to as a sandy range site. This was taken about a week after the fire. And if you'll notice in these photos, there's a T-post on the right-hand corner of the fire. All these photos are going to be taken at the same place to give us a good idea of what is taking place in that landscape. You can see in the sandy country right here that it's already responding. That's a month and a half after the fire. Some of these places are going to respond faster than others. This is a shinery country, much deeper sands than what you saw in the previous slide. Again, this is right after the fire. Not a lot of change. You can see in the background there is a little bit of green up beginning to take place. That's okay. This country is going to come back. Now we're looking at an area called McClellan Creek. A week after the fire, a month and a half later, it's beginning to green up. It's a little lower drainage area, a little bit tighter soils. It's going to be okay. This is an area called White Deer Creek. Kind of unique area. This area is going to respond much quicker because underneath the area it's somewhat sub-irrigated, a pretty high water table. That's what it looked like a month and a half later. You wouldn't have guessed it gone through the fires that some of the other range sites had. Now this fire will be long remembered by staff and be talked about as it is unlike anything many of us have ever seen in our lifetimes or ever will see. Staff is confident that the wildlife, the panhandle, and their associated habitats will bounce back. They've done it before. Now, that ends our briefing on the recent panhandle fires, and at this opportunity, we'll take the opportunity to address any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Reuben. I commend you on the work up there. I was up there not long ago, and you've been very busy. And you and your biologists and the wardens have done a great job helping those people out. Commissioner Bivens, you've seen it.
I think it's going to provide a real interesting opportunity to see on a burn basis how native grasses recover in comparison to CRP grasses. And hopefully it'll help in our efforts to improve the CRP grass types or the seed mix, so that we can come back in with the type of nutritional grasses that lesser prairie chickens and other game species can benefit more from. and it'll be an interesting laboratory.
Like I said, we've got a great opportunity, not something that we wish for, but this is, you might say, an opportunity of a lifetime. And that's going to be one of the things that we're looking at. And I think it's going to help us document the rate of recovery on native rangeland and help push and encourage a lot more people to use native grass seeds in some of their plants,
right,
like you said, CRP.
It's also amazing how blue quail will inhabit burned-out country. It pushes them out while the fire's going through it, but then once the fire's passed, they'll come right back in.
If you noticed in the video, antelope were going from the grassland into some fire that was still in some area that was still smoking. And we have to keep in mind that nature abhors a vacuum. It created one briefly, but it will be filling back up again.
Right.
We're confident of that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ruben, the impact on the resource, has the game moved to areas or pockets that perhaps were not impacted by the fires? Or how is that impacting our resource?
In some areas, it's going to increase the number of animals as far as the density figure on the outside areas. As Commissioner Bivens says, these animals are slowly moving back in. The Extension Service is looking at some long-term studies. They're trying to determine the rate of animal response moving back in an area. Some of these areas are over 20 miles wide and maybe wider. And they're looking at doing some population survey work at different distances from the burned area. How long is it going to take to repopulate an area 5 miles from a burn area, 10 miles in the burn area, 20 miles in the burn area? So we're going to be keeping our eye on all of that. So.
Just wanted to say to Major McCrary, be sure to let your team know how much we all appreciate the selflessness and the courage the warden showed and the enormous kind of heroic effort and the hours they put in. It was really dramatic hearing about it, both here and in writing for the communication pockets. We really appreciate all they did. Please thank you for us.
Thanks, Ruben. Next up is item 12, the wind energy development briefing. Kathy?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Kathy Boydston. I'm Program Leader with the Wildlife Division. I'm here to brief you on wind energy development in the state. Wind power development started in Texas in the late 90s and has increased dramatically in the last 3 years. There are several factors that are contributing to this. Texas leads all other states except California in available wind energy production. The energy bill passed in 2005 that extended the production tax credit to 2007. And Texas passed legislation the last session in the form of Senate Bill 20 that implemented a renewable portfolio standard, committing Texas to an additional 5,000 megawatts generated by renewable electricity by 2015, with 2,080 of those 5,000 megawatts by January 2007. Now, many people don't realize that Austin Energy is a leading seller of green energy in the United States and that many towns, smaller towns and cities in Texas are powered entirely by wind power, such as Corsicana. Currently, we have 30 existing and proposed wind farms in 13 counties in Texas. Wind power is considered a green energy source because it doesn't pollute, doesn't use water, creates electricity, and has fairly low environmental impact compared to other energy sources, such as coal-fired generation. There are currently 19 operating coal-fired power plants in Texas with 15 more planned. Coal power plants emit several different pollutants, one of which is an airborne form of mercury, which contributes to mercury concentration in 60 reservoirs in East Texas, 13 of which have fishing advisories. Wind power farms usually have a pretty standard business return and provide a stable economic investment over longer term than other energy types. Now, there is an economic benefit to landowners, local businesses, and communities. The landowner benefit can be as much as $2,000 to $6,000 per acre, depending on where they are, and they also can continue almost all their practices, such as hunting, grazing, and agricultural practices can continue around the turbines within a safe distance. The graphic that's been handed out to you shows the standard turbine and its dimensions. This is a little bit older model than most people will be using now. The tower is about 230 feet high. The blades are 120 feet long. The tips of the blades are approximately 100 feet from the surface of the ground. And when they're moving, tip speed can be anywhere from 90 to 150 miles an hour. So why is Parks and Wildlife interested in this? Well, since we're the agency responsible for fish and wildlife resources, and our code requires that we review these types of development projects. 12.0011 is a section of the code that my program operates under. We review all types of development projects all across the state, and wind power is just one of those types of development. Now, wind turbines have been shown to have impacts fairly minimal on some species in other states, primarily birds and bats. However, there's a lack of data in Texas on the potential impacts of these wind turbines on the bird migration corridors along the coast. We don't have any data that we, there's no data that we know of on post-construction bird mortality at existing wind farms. We don't have any idea what the impact of wind turbines would be on bat migration in Texas. And we don't know of any post-construction bat mortality studies that have been done at existing sites. However, studies in other states do show about bird mortality of about 2.19 birds per turbine per year. And other forms of avian mortality are vehicles, buildings, transmission lines, and communication towers. And you can see that those usually constitute a higher mortality rate than wind towers. In Texas, we're concerned about other species than birds and bats, such as the lesser prairie chickens and the rolling plain and the panhandle. Studies in other states have shown that lesser prairie chickens do not breed or raise young within a half mile of some vertical structures. And we all know that raptors feed on prairie dog colonies. Well, if the turbines are located in close proximity to a prairie dog colony, this can increase the potential for the birds to fly into the turbines while they're hunting. It also could increase the potential for collision with transmission lines that go from the facilities hooking into the electrical grid. And we know that bighorn sheep and the Trans-Pecos are very vulnerable to human disturbance, particularly during lambing. So there's no information that we know of that shows what the potential impacts of developing wind turbines in bighorn sheep territory would be. I have questions with development along the coast and offshore as well. As you all know, that this is a big issue for Texas right now, and it's only going to continue to grow. As indicated earlier, we don't know much about the bird migration corridors along the coast. And we don't know anything about bat populations and their migration along the coast either. We're concerned about what might happen with neotropical migrants and the impacts on their habitat. And as always, we're concerned with endangered species and their habitats. What impact could these developments have on those? We know that certain areas, redhead ducks move from salt water into in-water freshwater ponds. So to locate turbines in between those areas could pose a problem, although most studies that we know of in other states don't show waterfowl having a high mortality from wind turbines. And as always, new transmission lines could pose hazards to waterfowl and other birds that are flying in those areas. You're all probably familiar with the first wind farm that's been proposed along the Texas coast. Onshore, this is the Penascal Wind Farm on the Kennedy Ranch. We've been out there several times with the company, and we're working closely with them on the development of this project. They've leased 191,000 acres for 30 years. They're going to build only on the part of the ranch that's along Laguna Madre and Baffin Bay, and they'll develop approximately 500 acres of that site. Full build-out will be about 260 turbines. They'll produce 400 megawatts of energy, powering 110,000 homes, or about 423 homes per turbine. The company did contract a two-year study with the biology department of Texas A&M at Kingsville to study bird migration patterns at that site. And they established a technical advisory committee with representatives from PCWD, environmental organizations, and local birding groups. Now, this technical advisory committee will study the results of their survey, and they will also be reviewing developing post-construction surveys and looking helping the system in looking for potential mortality after post-construction. So what are we doing about all this? Well, there's no permitting process in this state and really no real regulation on the industry at this time. But we are working at the state and federal levels with state and federal agencies and other states as well on fish and wildlife issues. We've been asked to sit on the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies Policy Committee, which will look at the Fish and Wildlife Voluntary Guidelines for Wind Development and redo those to assess all the state's needs, but at a national level. We've been involved in meetings with wind industry, the environmental community, and birding groups to address wind energy development in the state and the implementation of Senate Bill 20. We've also been working closely and meeting with the Public Utility Commission on the implementation of Senate Bill 20 and the proposed new Rule 25174, which will establish competitive renewable energy zones for Texas, which this will indicate to the PUC where industry is planning on doing the most development so that the PUC and the energy providers can plan for new transmission lines that have to go to these areas. We're working real closely with everyone to make sure that environmental issues are considered in development of these zones and then also at each site development. We're also working on an assessment tool to help wind industry in the early stages of development. This is some of the known locations of wind farms, and look closely at the area that's outlined in red. This is a county-level view of the wind farms. The green circles show known listed plant populations, and the pink circles are known bird or mammal populations. It's important for these companies to know if listed species occur in close proximity to the areas where they're going to develop so that they know if the appropriate habitat is there. They need to survey pre-construction to find out if the species occur at their site and then work with us and the Fish and Wildlife Service to determine what needs to be done after that. This is just one layer of information that's going to be in this assessment tool that we hope will help them locate their wind farms in the least environmentally sensitive areas. That pretty much concludes my presentation, so if there's any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
The study you referenced for the Kennedy Ranch project, that will be the first one that's focused on coastal and migratory areas we have.
Yes, that we know of in the state. Parks and Wildlife is also partnering with Cesar Clayburgh Wildlife Research Institute, and we're doing a much larger study that involves the Texas, especially the lower Texas coast. It's a four-year study, and we're looking at basically bird migration corridors, studying how high they're going to fly, what relationship that has with weather and vegetation to determine, basically to get more information about the migration corridors, which nobody really has, and how birds actually migrate, and will projects like this, how will they impact migration or, transmission lines or communication towers.
But the study you referenced is not 4 years, the longer one.
No, right now it's 2 years. And I think by the time they finish, it'll be a three-year study.
Mm-hmm. And is that relevant as to a take from a federal endangered species standpoint? It's not relevant from any. We don't have any permitting jurisdiction in this regard. So I'm trying to get to what makes it relevant.
The study, what they're trying to do. Well, one couple of things make it relevant. Actually, there's a lot of local opposition to the project,
mm-hmm.
and then also there's the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which there is no provision for take in the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. So basically, anytime a bird hits a window, or you hit a car, your car hits a bird, or a bird dies from any facility, it's a take. It's a breaking of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. But of course, obviously, the Fish and Wildlife Service does not enforce that. Now, one thing that the company is doing is trying to show due diligence to comply with the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and site their wind farm as best they can and do as much upfront study as they can so that if a bad incident does happen, say they kill a lot of birds after the wind farm is erected, they will have done due diligence as best they can to show compliance with that.
But they could still get an action letter from the service if there isn't.
I think the stance that I have been told that the service is going to take is to see how well the company did due diligence as to decide whether they tend to file on them.
Others? Robert?
As far as the location, I think it says Penascal Point, is that right? The location of these units, so they're not actually going to be in the Laguna Madre, are they?
No.
So it's all on the surface.
They're just right there inland, right, really close to the shore. They're not going to be any farther inland than 5 miles. But they're going to be right on this particular site. They're going to be probably not less than a mile or so off of the Laguna Madre.
Okay.
You cited the... Oh, go ahead, Mark. Sorry. Aren't there plans to put another facility in, not necessarily in Laguna Madre, but somewhere in the waters of the Gulf of Mexico?
There's actually two. There's one that's proposed off of Galveston, and then there's one that was recently proposed off of Padre Island.
Just
on the other side from where, and a little bit south from where Penascal is, but it's on the Gulf side of Padre Island.
Okay. You cited mortality statistics at 2.1 birds per turbine per year. How much data is that based on? Is that a large sample, small sample, and how much does it vary what I've read is that when you get a concentrated slot that migratory birds move through, you get a lot of mortality in that particular little area as opposed to just an average. Is that an average of a whole lot of data?
That's an average of several years worth of data from several different studies, is my understanding. And most of the studies that show that look at bird mortality associated with wind turbines, birds are really usually able to avoid the turbines, even when they're at night. And usually there's a weather event such as fog or a storm or some weather event that's associated with that forces them down into the turbine. Because most of the time, birds, we know what information that we do have on bird migration from other states shows that they migrate at a higher altitude than turbines exist.
How uniform is the incidence of mortality across the whole sample?
I don't really have that information. I have somebody here that might be able to answer that question. No?
Kathy, Mr. Chairman, I want to be sure the commission understands, because we run into this kind of thing quite a bit. Our responsibility when a project like this is proposed, where we're not granting the permit, but we're asked to comment on potential impacts on fish and wildlife. And we do that to the best of our ability. We try to base it off of known factors, off the data. Our people keep up with all the research studies, all the information around the nation and around the world that is available. But there's just not sites like this one where it's been tried. And that's what got everybody very concerned, and the industry itself is concerned. But it's potentially, and the offshore sites are potentially very productive sites for a clean power source. But it is certainly a concern. You start chopping up a bunch of migratory birds, well, I don't know, there'll be some real issues there. But it almost has to happen to be documented before that comes into play. It's a relative point to our next presentation also, I might add.
Well, you seem to get these in the right order. Any other questions? Yeah, sure, Ned.
I was kind of struck by the size of the lease in terms of acreage versus the size of the area where they were going to put the wind farm. Can you give us any color on that?
It's like you getting a hunting lease. What they did was they leased up all the acreage that they thought could be potential sites for wind development. So they leased up that whole area in order to prevent other companies from trying to develop on that site next to them. Kind of like you lease a hunting, pasture or a property for hunting. You don't want anybody else hunting out there, so you lease up the whole property. That's basically what they've done.
Thank you. Any other questions?
One quick one. Do you know of any devices or whistles or something that's in these systems or units that will actually deter birds from going into the area?
My understanding is there's been quite a bit of research done on that, and it's usually those are fairly ineffective. One of the things that they found that's been most effective is their lighting schemes. They've done a lot of research on changing the lighting at night on these turbines to not attract birds to fly into them under low light or bad weather conditions. But as far as any kind of noise or sound, that's been fairly ineffectual, is my understanding.
Thank you very much. Next briefing item up, Larry McKitty, Liquefied Natural Gas Facilities in Texas.
Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Larry McKinney, Director of Coastal Fisheries. And for the record, I have an excellent working relationship with my counterparts in Florida. I think they do a wonderful job. And if there's any issues that arise out of this meeting, it's clearly with an inland area, not with me. I'll make that on the record. Appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about on this topic, liquefied natural gas issues in Texas. It's been an interesting exercise putting this together. Let's start basically with just some general information, which I'm sure you're familiar with, but we probably ought to go over with about what we're talking about. Liquefied natural gas is really what they do is they super cool natural gas and then ship it in specialized containers, and you see a picture of one of the vessels there. They're basically giant thermos bottles is what they amount to, move the gas across the oceans to the facilities where at the facility, at the receiving end, they again have to regasify that liquid and then store it temporarily and then transport it in pipelines. As you can see from the maps, where the supplies exist are around the world, most of them, of course, being not in North America. So our end of the LNG business is in the receiving end for the most part. And in that, because of, I guess, changing economic situations and a number of other factors coming along, the interest in LNG facilities has grown tremendously over the last several years. We had originally four existing facilities, but right now we have 10, as far as proposed or even approved. We have 10 that are looked at in the East Coast, another 10 on the West Coast, and in the Gulf of Mexico, 16 facilities that are being looked at. Now, these are all facilities that are being licensed and proposed, not necessarily built. I don't know how many economically will actually come to fruition, but these are the ones that are in the works right now. If we drill in a little bit and take a look at the Gulf of Mexico, you can see the number of facilities, 16, that we're looking at there, and you get an idea of their distribution. And if we drill in a little further, we can talk about those in Texas. One at the Pearl Landing site, Pearl Crossing site, was one that was proposed, has been withdrawn. When you look at numbers, a couple of them are just being looked at or proposed at this time. No real action taken on here. Two of them in Cameron and Bay Crossing. That in review is Beacon Port, an offshore facility that's in review right now. Those that have received their license and permits are there in red. You can see that there's four of them. The Port Arthur one, just to make that point, it's pending. It's not quite there yet, but they have received their EIS and their record of decision and just waiting on the core permit, so it's coming along. And then under construction, you can see those. So that's the activity that's going on the coast. I would tell you that that from a staff perspective, working and reviewing of these projects over the last period of time that we've been involved, this has been the biggest challenge that we've ever faced in my 20 years here. Of trying to review and work with these projects. They're all on a very fast track to move forward, and just trying to meet those deadlines and get the reviews in have been difficult, and that's true across the board. So it's been a real challenge to look in this area. So let's take a look at these for a second. First, there are two types of these facilities, onshore and offshore, and let's take a look at those, talk about those for a second. We have 9 facilities proposed or licensed in Texas. The onshore facilities are all handled by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, and all of these facilities have agreed to use closed-loop systems. Some of them did start, at least their initial proposals were to go to open-loop, but all have now converted to using this closed-loop. And the top of what we're talking about there is once the gas comes in the liquid form, you have to, again, of course, heat it up. It heats back up in order to put it in the pipeline and move it off. So you have a couple of options. One option is just to run water through the facility, large volumes of water, and let the water naturally warm the gas up. And, of course, it cools the water down as it does that. And then and that way, and that's an open-loop system. The closed-loop type systems use part of that gas itself to actually heat it or something like that. We don't use those large volumes of water. They use to heat it up in some mechanical or electrical or chemical way. So that's another version. For the onshore facilities, the impacts have been primarily issues of pipelines and development, which are very, very common, very typical for what we do for any type of industrial site. And you talked about one yesterday, and we're looking at easement for one, and we've worked on those as well. So those types of impacts are very straightforward for us. We work with them every day, be they power lines or pipelines. A majority of the project proponents have worked with us on those projects. We've had good relationships with them. Of course, we've had some differences in having to move forward and trying to resolve those, but on the whole, we've worked well with them. And Commissioner Parker has been involved in some working with us there, have even come up with some innovative ideas of using fresh water on some of these coastal areas to then take the fresh water and use it to move fresh water into some of the wetlands and help us there. So those things have been actually very interesting to take a look at. This is to give you an idea of a typical facility. They're all about this size. You can see they have receiving where the ships come in, handling, and the pipelines and the big tanks to store it. They all look about like this on the onshore side. And when you take a look at the typical impacts, this is what we were talking about, pipeline type of things that we have to deal with, mitigation and restoration type activities in regards to them. Now, as far as the offshore facilities, this is where we have our concerns and certainly most looking at them. Currently, there is one application filed for offshore adjacent to Texas waters between Texas and Louisiana. This is the ConocoPhillips Beacon Port off of High Island that we're looking at. The next bullet there, that's an error. This is, I forgot to update this this section. There's actually been two facilities that have been approved. They are open loop systems, Port Pelican and another one called Energy Gateway. Those were approved initially. Frankly, they got in under the wire before people started realizing that they were issues and got them done and began to look at them, so they're there. One, as I told you, one of the offshore facilities has been withdrawn, Pearl Crossing, and just within the last week and a half or two, another one was vetoed by the governor of Louisiana. Basically, what happens under those facilities, under the federal law, these facilities, when they're located off of state waters or adjacent to the governor of that state or adjacent state, have the right in the end to veto those proposals and can't act on it, and she did in that particular one. One of the concerns, of course, is that for the most part, the LNG facilities in the Gulf of Mexico, at least initially, offshore facilities have proposed and continue to propose to use open rack or open loop systems. This type of approach has not been, for those facilities that are being developed on the East Coast and West Coast, that is not a situation. They are not have not gone there. They're not allowed to, or they perhaps not chose not to. It could be either one of those reasons. But the only place that are considering, only place in the U.S. in which open-loop systems are considered, are being considered, are here in the Gulf of Mexico at this time. So that's, one that we're looking at right now, of course, is Beacon Port, which continues to propose to use an open-loop system. To give you an idea of at least one concept of what these systems look like, very typical. They're offshore rig-type structures that we see, just large facilities where the ships come in and offload and then do the whole process offshore and then pipe it in. One of the reasons, of course, that the Gulf of Mexico we're seeing a lot of interest in this activity. Of course, our pipeline system, that's the big issue, is moving this gas through our pipeline system. And clearly, from our facilities here in the Gulf, Louisiana and Texas and Alabama and Mississippi, we have that system. So that's why these companies are very interested in taking advantage of that pipeline, which you could understand. Well, let's talk about some of our issues and concerns we have with the open loop facility. Basically, these systems will be drawing somewhere between 1 and 200 million gallons a day through their facility to achieve this heating up of the gas, of the gas returning to the gas state. The concern, of course, is the temperature drops that occur as that water passes through that system, anywhere that says here from 13 to 30 degrees temperature differential as it goes through the system. Of course, they're going to be concerned about fouling in those systems. They're just like big radiators. And so they'll be using chemicals to keep that fouling down, and that's another concern of what type of chemical agent they'll be using to create that biofouling issue. And that, of course, has some impacts as well. The numbers here, and I've put up, and I want to be very careful about this, but these are some of this, but I want to be clear. The companies that are proposing the open loop systems basically assert that the savings in operational costs to them, and they're considerable, $20 to $30 million, it will cost them an additional $20 to $30 million a year to use a closed-loop system as opposed to open-loop. They feel and assert that the risk to public resources, and of course what we're talking about here is when that water is sucked through those you're taking up the larvae, eggs of redfish and trout and red snapper and all those types of things. They have felt that the risk to those resources are either avoidable or minimal, or that they could be mitigated. Or in some cases, and by mitigation, I mean either compensated for, or if the facilities are put in, I think some of the proposals, for example, look toward, we'll put the facility in, we will monitor those activities. If problems occur, we'll make adjustments accordingly to again minimize any impacts that occur. The problems that we have in this area is that that in fact those assertions are not widely agreed to. The governor of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama have all expressed concerns or opposition to open loop based on unknowns that they can't really assess those impacts. Our sister agencies in the other states that have looked at this as well, in Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, have all expressed similar concerns to that we have. All the federal resource agencies similarly have those concerns, as have the federal agencies such as the Gulf Marine Fisheries Commission and the Gulf Council. All have basically expressed concerns about impact. Where my dilemma in this is, or our staff is that, you know, when we look at our projects and activities on our coast and in our waters, we are really blessed with having a tremendous amount of data on which to fall back and really do analysis. We just don't have that here in the offshore waters. We don't have sufficient data to either. The analysis that I've seen from those companies that have done these analysis for the open loop, and that their approaches, I think, are less than what I would like to see. I don't think they're very well done, frankly, and the information is not there to do it. On the other hand, the issues what I've listed here, some of the concerns there, where we'd lose the billions of eggs and so forth, and the amounts of impacts to fisheries, I think we can't actually prove that up either. As the chairman asked me the other day, if I was in court testifying on this, would I be able to stand up and stand behind some of the information, the assertions that I have seen, and unfortunately I cannot. So the basic issue where we do fall back is I do have a lot of familiarity, do know issues of entrainment and how we dealt with power plants and the impacts of water going through power plants. I know what can happen. So in this situation, our approach has been to be as you would hope, we would expect it to be as conservative as possible, because we do know there will be impact. And the best evidence that we have, those concerns are real across the basis that they can be substantial. And so we would prefer to take a cautionary approach to those types of things and say if there are other alternative methods or ways to put these facilities in, like closed-loop systems that others are using, then that, from a Fish and Wildlife perspective, is the route we ought to take. And so that's where we stand at this point. We are certainly talking with the industry, and in fact, Ray Sullivan is here today, and folks from ConocoPhillips, I think they're here in the audience today, and certainly could be glad to answer any questions you have. We're working with them closely as they move forward in whatever perspective, but we have maintained from a staff perspective our concern and opposition to open-loop systems because of those general concerns we have. So with that, be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Larry, what's the longest operating open loop system that you're aware of? I mean, that we would have the most data.
I think the one on the East Coast. I can't remember the name of it, but there's not. They have not collected much information. It's a little bit different situation. So I don't really have any data that. The ones in the Gulf have not been operating that long and have not collected the data.
That's are there any operating open loop systems in the Gulf today?
Two that are permitted. They're permitted.
Are there any operating?
One ready to begin to operate, I believe. I don't know exactly where it is.
We don't have. There's none operating today.
No, not with any. They may have done some work, and I'll have to check on that for you. But not enough to collect any information at all. This is what we need.
Where are Ned? We'll go down the line here, Ned.
Larry, did I understand that there were 40 open loop systems in operation in other parts of the world?
No, there are no open loop systems. There may be some, but not for the ones that are being proposed for the East Coast and West Coast.
No, I meant anywhere in the world.
I don't know. I don't know what the worldwide. I don't know. The ones that I've checked on recently, for example, in India. That were proposed there, they are not being allowed to use to open. They're going closed. So,
I was talking about in operation.
Oh, I'm not familiar with them. Don't know.
It would be an interesting exercise
to
if there were some that were in operation, then you might be able to actually collect data.
Well, looking at the staff, of course, there'd be different situations because of depths and the types of water, and of course, we have particular issues because of. Our very shallow water, here and the redfish and so forth that, that spawn offshore. There's some concerns there that may not be existing in other places.
The one in question now is Beacon Point, is that
That's
it?
That's the one that's under review right now.
But there are, what did you say, 7 or 8 more that are also proposed as open loop?
Let's see, well, there's a couple more. I'll pull my sheet. I should have that memorized. But the main pass one that was recently vetoed by Louisiana, they've changed over to closed loop now. I should have had that memorized by now. Sorry. I'll have to get that for you as to the actual numbers. I think there are 2 or 3.
How far offshore? I mean, it's pretty hard to tell from the schematic. Do you know how far offshore Beacon Point is proposing?
No, I don't remember the depth. I'm sorry, I don't have it. Should.
Seemed like it was 15, 20 miles.
I was going to say 20, but raise it.
50 miles offshore. So I can get a better understanding, did I understand the slide to say that the water differential could be as much as 30 degrees Fahrenheit?
That's the range.
Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Would that potentially take it below freezing?
No, I don't think we would ever get in that situation. I don't think the water out that far in the ocean does not get that.
How do we go about collecting data to understand what this would do?
Well, that's one of the Beacon Port proposed to go ahead and put the facility in and then to collect that data, and then they're working on a monitoring plan to do that and then adjust once we see what happens. But it's just not there.
I understand you just say just a minute ago that there's one that is getting ready to start operation. Mm-hmm. Off the Texas coast?
No, not off the Texas coast. It's off Louisiana.
Off Louisiana.
Yeah. And I'm sure they're working with them on monitoring plans as well, so we'll get some data.
Do we have jurisdiction 50 miles off the coast?
No, only under this particular act. It's considered adjacent waters, so our governor, the two governors, Texas or Louisiana, do have veto power over those because of the provisions of the federal act.
Well, walk us through that permit system. Who issues the permit exactly?
This one is these. Let me go back to the onshore ones here. You can see that there. I put it in there. They're handled by the Coast Guard, and they're a different group, but they're running through the same. They have to do an EIS. They have to do those analyses. It's an EIS process, so it follows that typically. Is that what you're...
How do you do the environmental impact statement if you don't have any data?
Well, and this is not unusual because in many cases we don't. They use the data that's available. Whatever's available, they use and do the best job that they can. And I think in looking at what has happened in those FESs, there's a number of questions been raised about the analysis that has been made about those impacts. That they are questionable. And they would be the same for the other side because there's a real paucity of data and how you deal with it, and that's an issue. So on neither side of it can you make, I don't feel comfortable on that there's minimal impact or that there's significant impact. Just can't make that call. Data's not there.
One of the things that we might be able to determine is what exactly is what aquatic life is spawning at that 50-mile range.
Well, that's really the data we're talking about. Unfortunately, the National Marine Fisheries Service that takes that required to take that data, they do. It's under a program called CMAP. But it has been so underfunded over the years that they have some data, but it's just not sufficient for something like this. It's just not there. And they have some ideas, and they're using it, but it's not very good data.
I was always under the impression that redfish spawned significantly closer to the shoreline. Did redfish spawn 50 miles out?
Yes, they can be there, but I don't know what numbers. And there's others, red snapper and others. And depending on the facility... again, I was kind of mixing those up, looking at all of this. Depending on the facility and location, you're going to have more concern with redfish in closer, red snapper out further, the migratory bird, migratory fish as well. So it's a mix.
I guess it's kind of interesting that we've had two briefing items right in a row that deal with energy. It's clearly one of the most significant issues that our country is going to face. And we want to be careful in how we do it.
Well, exactly. I mean, that from our perspective, we understand, and there's the LNG facilities are safe, and there's something we're going to have to meet, just like wind power and those types of things. What we're trying to work out, what is the best approach from a Fish and Wildlife perspective? There's a lot of things that decision makers are going to have to weigh in this case when they look at this. From the Fish and Wildlife perspective, the unknowns for us are significant enough to say we ought to err on the side of caution. We know that the closed-loop systems can work. We would prefer to go that direction rather than take the risk. There are other perspectives that we understand as well.
With the $20-30 million a year.
Now, again, I'm very careful about that because that's been, I put that in there. Probably should have not put that in. That has been laid out by others. I can't make
the cost. The economic delta in operating costs.
Some of the folks have predicted concerns of, for example, 8% of all the redfish in the Gulf of Mexico production could be lost, and in Louisiana up to 11% of their redfish production could be lost because of these things. Then you translate that into dollars. That's where I think they get these dollars. But again, when I look at those, I understand what they've done, but the data's not what I would like for it to be.
Well, it looks to me like with that kind of potential difference in operating costs, there is scope for some significant mitigation dollars.
Well, yes, and I think some groups are certainly thinking about that.
Larry, I was going to head where Ned said it. If $20 to $30 million a year, if you capitalize that even at a low multiple of 10, there's $200 to $300 million of value swing in the value of these facilities to the investors who are putting up the money. That's exactly where I was going. There's a lot of room for mitigation. Can these effects you're describing be mitigated? If they could be quantified, could they be mitigated?
If I knew what the scope of the impact was, I would be better positioned to answer. I just don't know. But certainly there are actions that can be taken to mitigate these types of things if they occur. Whether they can do so to the extent of the loss that would take place, no. And we've looked at those types of things. So at this point, until we can get better information, we've erred on the side of we prefer to go to closed systems as we did on the inshore ones to avoid having to try to go through that.
And second question on the open, is it possible for them to really just to run a conduit, a pipe, further offshore to get away from the shallow breeding grounds to areas where they will have a lessened impact so that the intake and the discharge of warm water is removed from the highly sensitive areas?
No, not really, because of the shallowness of the area and it's such a broad area, but those companies are certainly looking at ways to avoid that. They are looking at, for example, and come to talk to us about ideas of their intakes being higher in the water and lower and being variable, so depending on season they could actually change when they bring water in. So they're looking at issues and they're setting themselves up so if they do move forward, if they can move forward, that they could take some actions to minimize those impacts and have it already in place, and we appreciate that, and I think that's a good progress.
What's the water depth in that 50-mile area, do we know?
No, I can't do much. I'm going to turn around and ask Reagan if I know he'll know. He'll do that. 65.
So, relatively.
And let me go ahead and introduce Ray and Tom, and you come on up here. And if there are any questions, I know this is a briefing item, Tom. We're not taking any action. Okay. Tom Sellers with ConocoPhillips, and Ray Sullivan with Sullivan Public Affairs. Come on up and take a seat, and you can. We may refer some questions to you. John Parker.
Dr. McKinney. Let's go back to the Texas Gulf Coast slide.
Well, I just clicked past. You're going to have to help me out here. I didn't mean to click back that far. I probably threw them off. Okay. Am I in the front of it?
Yep.
Remember this from yesterday? I'm going to get. This is the one?
Nope. Just showing Texas Gulf Coast.
Yep.
There. Now.
Okay.
There. Now. How many of those along the coast, on the coast, are operational now?
None of those. They're all under construction. The greens are under construction. The reds are permitted and could go to construction.
Okay. They're under construction now. But all of those are going to be closed-loop systems?
All the closed-loop systems, yes.
Then why have those people chosen to go with a closed-loop system, the ones farther out chosen to go with an open-loop system?
Well, some of the insurance were proposed for open loop, but when you take a look at the amount of water that's going to be moving through there, 100 to 200 million gallons a day in a closed system in a bay, you could recycle significant parts of a bay quite rapidly, and everyone would recognize that as clearly a serious issue. When you move offshore, of course, the volumes of water are obviously tremendously larger, and the depths, as you see here, are greater. So you don't have that issue of a confined space like you're putting a hose into a small tub and sucking it out versus a swimming pool. Is that getting at your answer? It's a matter of volume and area. That's primarily it.
But we also have concerns of the offshore sucking up the larva.
Right.
Plankton.
They are there.
Not only
right.
the larva, but what they feed on.
Yes. Yes. And that's the question. What is that volume of it? Is it billions or millions or what? Or can it be avoided? That's the issue of which we don't have the data to make that call. If I was in coastal waters and inshore, I could make that call for you. I could give you a good estimate because I have it. But we don't sample out there in the Gulf, and they don't have the sufficient resources to do
so. You're saying that we have to build one, find out if we're going to have a crisis or not.
Well, that's an approach. That's one way to do it. Try it and see, and then be ready to react. I mean, in the sense of, and then be ready to react and change to some other approach if the impacts are what some of us might be concerned about.
Kind of like a batter going to the batter's box in a game. He's already got he starts off with one or two strikes.
Can be.
Isn't that exactly what is happening, though? Didn't you say that there were two?
There are two that have been permitted earlier. Yeah, so we'll get some information. Those are going to happen.
So it's going to happen anyway. It's happening off of Louisiana.
Right. And I think Louisiana folks are concerned that it's the cumulative impact of a number of these facilities moving so much water over here.
Right. That just as a curiosity, and I think I'm probably addressing this to you, Mr. Chairman. I don't recall this issue having been debated at the commission before.
No.
If we developed a position on it, is there a policy position on open versus closed loop?
I think the staff's made their professional and scientific opinion pretty clear. But to answer your question, no. But it goes. If we don't have a commission policy, there seems to be a bit of a chicken and the egg here of the mitigation issue. Well, if you can mitigate, and I understand that, of course, any industry would offer to mitigate the impact. The question is, what are you mitigating? Until you know what the impact is, you don't know what the level of mitigation, or even if it's possible to mitigate that impact. I want to go back a second because I'm particular about getting my facts straight. The open loop terminals that have been permitted are two, correct?
That's correct.
One off Louisiana?
Well, actually both off Louisiana.
Both off Louisiana.
Energy Bridge and Pelican.
Okay, so there is no permitted open loop off Texas presently.
No.
Okay, trying to get these facts straight. All right. Now, why didn't Governor Blanco veto the other two if he's vetoed the most recent?
That I don't know. I'd ask that question that only that those facilities, those permits went in so, when I asked staff about that, that those permits went so quickly and actually went in the process that
okay.
No one had actually anticipated or issued.
For the purpose of Texas, though, we have no permitted open loop today. So the issue, it seems to me, that we need to struggle with here is if we, depending on how we come out on this, you're going to be setting a precedent for Texas. And the impact, because clearly it's much cheaper to do the open loop. If Texas has an open loop policy, somebody's BlackBerry just busted them. If we have an open, if we allow open loop, we're going to attract open loop. If it's not allowed in other coastal areas, I mean, I think that my University of Chicago economist is over here.
A lot of people want in, and we're cheaper, they're going to be here. You can count on
it. Yeah, so, right. If a lot of people want in, and it's $30 million, you're cheaper to do it here, you're going to get a lot of them. So it's really an issue of cumulative effect. Correct?
Yes.
All right.
But it has not deterred, the people from asking for permits and stating that they're going closed loop on our shoreline.
No, sir. These are all closed loops, and then they're moving forward, as you can see there, at various levels.
Just so I can get the procedure straight here, this is a briefing item, so understand that nobody, this is not public testimony. We're not making a decision here. We're just learning. And with that said, I'm sorry, I didn't get your name. Identify yourself.
Joyce Miley.
And who you're with for the record.
I'm with ConocoPhillips. My job title is Director of Stakeholder Relations for Global Gas. I have two Texas facilities that I'm responsible for. One is the Freeport LNG project. The other is a Deaconport project. My Freeport LNG project, that project is onshore Texas. It is under construction. It is a closed-loop process. We decided to permit this as a closed-loop process for two reasons. One, because it's in a nearshore environment, we felt that the biology would be too prevalent, that it would be difficult to run that as an open loop. And the other is the waters that we would be drawing from are silt-laden. It's the Brazos River water in the intercoastal that we would need to take the water from. And engineering-wise, it would be extremely difficult to clean up that water to get rid of the sediment so that you could work it through the process. So on the Freeport LNG, we chose the closed loop because of engineering and environmental reasons. Offshore in Texas, Pearl Crossing, although it is withdrawn, is permitted as an open loop facility. The company is not moving forward with that, but you already have one that has been permitted. The Deaconport, we are working on the application to permit it as an open rack vaporization, which is the open loop, which is using the seawater. ConocoPhillips is also working offshore Alabama. That offshore Alabama is Compass Port. That should go through government approval or veto on June 11th, on or before June 11th. So we are much further along in the process on our Compass Port facility. On that one, we started in October of 2004 to collect site-specific marine information on more than a monthly basis. We hired a reputable marine institute to go out there on a regular basis. We have thousands of samples where we have looked on the stratigraphic water column so that we could determine what eggs, what larvae, what time of the year, in what layer. And we are seeing results. Dr. George Crozier with the Dolphin Island Sea Lab is a scientist responsible for that. We have promised that we would do the same study for Deaconport and have at least 3 years of knowledge prior to actual construction out there, and then additional monitoring, both of those projects, monitoring and mitigation. And so we've promised that these projects would go forward that way. There are two, you asked about otherwhere, you know, in the world. Accelerate offshore Louisiana has had two, possibly three cargoes already come in. They are monitoring, they're collecting information. So that's the closest we could find to Texas of an operating open loop. Shell Gulf Landing has also been permitted. They are offshore Louisiana. They are not under construction yet, so there's no information available on that one. East Coast and West Coast of the United States, there are no open loop projects, but there are over 40 around the world that have been operating since 1969. The reason I know that date is ConocoPhillips created our first liquefaction terminal in Alaska, and we've been sending LNG around the world since 1969. Open loop systems are the most prevalently used systems around the world. If they are in areas where they can get a good source of water, whether it be fresh or salt, almost all of the open loop systems are in the nearshore environment. It's the Shell Gulf Landing, the Pearl Crossing, the Beacon Port, our Compass Port, the Accelerate. Some of those others are offshore. So most of the over 40 are in a nearshore, if not onshore, environment.
Go ahead, John.
You know, for me personally, at some future date, be sooner than later, I would like for you to consider inviting Dr. Earl to come give us her vast knowledge of helping out here.
So I think A&M Corpus Christi and the Heart Research Institute is a good place.
What did you say?
I think A&M Corpus Christi and Heart Research Institute, which Dr. Earl chairs, would be a good resource for us to consult in this matter. Right now, I'm just trying to gather the facts, and already my facts are starting to move on me here a little bit. We do then have, I understand, a single LNG terminal that is... Is that me? No, it's not me. Permitted but withdrawn. What is the significance of being withdrawn? Can it be re-permitted without a new review or what?
The company made the decision that they were not ready to build at this time. And so they told the United States Coast Guard and MARAD that their application will not be progressed forward. MARAD asked if they could withdraw to change the cumulative impact study, because any project that comes up from here on out needs to bring in all the water use, even of those facilities that have been permitted.
All right, let me ask my question a little bit more directly. Do they need to re-permit if it's withdrawn?
I don't know.
Okay. So what I'm really trying to get to this simple point for us as policymakers to try and understand. Is there or is there not a threshold which has already been crossed of allowing open loop in Texas? And as I understand it from what you said, no, because that one was the one that was permitted has been withdrawn. So we are at the I wouldn't say case of first impression, but we are dealing with the threshold.
Yes.
Yeah, Jonathan.
As part of the permitting process, are you required to make representations to the agency as to the significance or impact on the environment? Is that a condition to the permitting process?
Over 3 years ago, we put in our application. And in our application, we took the CMAP data, and we used those results to come up with our estimates of what the impact might be. The U.S. Coast Guard then hired their own environmental consultants who independently did the work, and they also spoke to the agencies that they felt had the most knowledge, and that's where Texas Parks and Wildlife comes in. So it was a joint. We put the application in. U.S. Coast Guard used their scientists to test it, and they went to the agencies, your local agency, to say what is your opinion.
Has the regulatory agency that governs you and issues a permit indicate their preference for an open or a closed system?
The license that will be received after the final EIS comes out will have the decision made. It is not made up until this point. The license that came out on Pearl Crossing said it was okay to use open loop. The license that came out on Accelerate in Louisiana said it was okay to use open loop. The license that came out on the Gulf Landing offshore Louisiana said it was okay. The license that is expected to come out on that main pass, since it was vetoed by the governor, cannot say they can use open loop because the governor said no.
My question relates to the state of Texas. Has the state of Texas regulatory agencies taken a position recommending an open or a closed loop? In other words, it's directed to... It seems to me that you're the one that's applying for the permit, and you're going to an agency. And my question is whether the agency has indicated to you, to ConocoPhillips, whether they prefer an open or a closed loop.
This is, of course, an entirely federal process. It doesn't go through the state regulatory process,
right,
the Coast Guard and others. And I don't think, I mean, I'm going to speak, that regulatory agency wouldn't do that until they will wait till they have all the documents and make a decision.
Typically, in this type of a permitting process, staff will make a recommendation, and that's my question to you, is whether staff, the regulatory agency, is recommending a closed loop as compared to an open, but in spite of that, the decision was to make it an open loop. That's my question. What staff recommended as a condition for the issuance of the permit?
Ask a different way. Does NOAA or National Marine Fisheries have a position on open versus closed loop and offshore?
They have raised their concerns about open systems. They have said closed loop is what they would prefer.
That's my question.
Yeah, those are commenting agencies. Those are agencies in the federal system that review.
Which is fine. But the regulatory agency is recommending a closed system. Correct?
No, they're not referring the regulatory agency. The Coast Guard is the regulatory
Coast Guard.
And they have, I'm not aware that they've made a statement of any type as far as...
And now, as part of the permitting process, to the extent that... do you know whether a condition of a permit is that you make certain representations with regards to what you would do in the event of an impact on the resource? And what is that representation?
Those have not been established for this project yet. We're working with Dr. McKinney, we're working with NOAA, we're working with EPA to establish what those conditions might be. We have some proposed. Our Compass Port, I could talk about more because it's further along in the process. But as a company, we know that there will be some impacts. The MARAD and the U.S. Coast Guard has recognized that there will be some impacts. And we have agreed to modify our technology that's a variable intake so that we take from an area of the water column that we feel at that time has the least amount of impact there. And we are working on other kinds of operational conditions that will help reduce the impact. We're also talking about monetary restoration and working with the local agencies, the state agencies, on giving them monetary restorations to help mitigate and restore any of the impacts that we might have.
Well, and I would assume that would be by putting up a letter of credit to cover any impact. I mean, do you know whether it's gone that far?
We would work through individually. That's why we're keeping a working relationship and education and talking back and forth. That's the only way it can be done.
What happens, since you don't know what the impact will be, what if the impact exceeds the ability to mitigate?
We have made the promise that if it cannot be corrected using the system that we are proposing, that we will shut down or change systems. And that will be in the license. It's currently in the Shell Gulf Landing license.
Let's take a little time to get around. Phil.
My knowledge on this subject is now limited to what we've heard today, first briefing I've had. I think this is a big issue for us. has implications for that affect national energy policy, employment in Texas, perhaps a lot of plants. I would prefer personally that we not have a policy. We are in charge of making the policy until we have taken the time, and probably intensely and quickly, in fairness to the groups who are trying to start these projects, for much more detailed briefing on the substantive issues you've raised, Dr. McKinney, because there's clearly a lot of uncertainty related to some of these. But I can sit here in my mind and think, can you mitigate? Are there contingent steps that could be made to allow post-opening solutions? And I'm uncomfortable with going forward with any recommendations as an agency that the commission hasn't endorsed as a matter of policy. I think the commission should set policy and should endorse our policy. But I also think we need to know a lot more before we can make a decision. I don't know what my decision will be without knowing a lot more.
Well, keep in mind that we don't have regulatory jurisdiction yet.
But
our comment, I think our policy and our comments are important. I agree with you. You said it well. If it's $30 million a year cheaper to operate LNG in Texas and we allow open loop, you're going to get a lot of them. So you need to really be looking at this not from the standpoint of permitting the impact for one, but essentially establishing your standard for Texas.
Understood. But by virtue of that exact comment, you're also saying it's a very significant economic issue.
Absolutely.
Very significant energy issue. So I realize our job is comment on wildlife, but our job as a commission is to set policy, and we have a de facto policy that's underway. I think it should be stopped and reviewed, and we should either endorse or not endorse whatever our policy is as a commission. This is a big policy matter. What we're supposed to do.
Well, let me make a point for you here. You actually have no control over the process. It's a federal process, and they're going to move forward and have to make a decision within the timelines and time frames. So that's happening. I mean, this is the type of thing we deal with every day on these processes, that we try to follow them and work with them. So there's no stopping this train. The folks have, the companies have considerable investments and need to move forward on them, and the regulatory process is set by law as to where they go. So that's where we get into these situations where we have to make our best judgment with the information we have available. But and I think it was well said here that what the company's trying to do is to set up a scenario so they can move forward in that uncertainty. And we do appreciate that approach. I think it's a very straightforward and
Larry, do you believe that our comments and recommendations have any impact on the outcome of the decision made by the permitting agency?
Coast Guard and MIRA, in this sense, I think they have some impact. Certainly, the cumulative impact of all agencies and others has an impact because of those concerns.
Therefore, the way we make those comments and how we weight the judgments we make does reflect a policy and has potential implications in the outcomes that occur.
I just think you have to be careful. I mean, this is a huge project. This is a big issue. But we deal with these things on one scale or another every day. The commission doesn't want to be in a position passing policy on what our biologists do every day on permit reviews and those types of things. I think you would be have a problem.
Not on individual permits, no. I understand.
But on the day, and these are bigger issues, and you have done that type of thing. So I'm not quite following you. I think maybe I just want to make that point.
Well, I think there are policy dimensions to this that we should weigh in on in the broad sense, in a general sense. I do not think the commission should get involved in individual issues, but I think we should understand and either endorse or not endorse policy recommendations of what our agency should be.
On broad scope,
that is. On broad scope,
and
that is.
I'm not disagreeing. I think this is, I'm sure we think.
Let me just add something. It would seem to me that to the extent that our resource is being impacted by this permit, that the regulatory agency would permit us to have standing, just like in any, if I ask for a particular permit, anyone that's impacted by that permit has standing before the law. So it seems to me that to the extent that ConocoPhillips or any company is interested in obtaining a permit that will impact our resource, that we have standing to go to that regulatory agency and say, before you consider this, you ought to consider it. I think it's an issue of intervention or standing. And so although we technically are not a permittee, I think anyone who's impacted would have standing.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask Ms. Miley a question just for clarification. Was the $20 to $30 million a year savings a number from ConocoPhillips?
No, sir. To use a system that will burn the liquefied natural gas, it's estimated because of the volume that when we want a 1.5 BCF a day, they calculate it will take between 1% and 2% of the liquefied natural gas that comes in. And so, not knowing what the value of the gas is, we have never come up with a number.
Where did that number come from?
Those were from other facilities that have gone through that, made those estimates. So it's just in general what I heard.
Yeah. Ms. Miley, there's obviously an economic reason why you want an open system rather than a closed one. And give us some, if these are not your numbers, I thought they were your numbers.
No, sir.
You obviously have some view as to the economic benefit from being in an open rack system. What is that?
The company had to, when we selected this location, look at the economics of it. It costs twice as much to build offshore, so that we have an additional capital outlay to go offshore. And then we need to entice suppliers to literally give us long-term contracts to bring the supply in. And every supplier is trying to get the most money that they can for each facility. So if you look at an offshore that's got a longer time to recover the cost for capital investment versus an onshore, their profit is less. And then when you look at the distance from the regasification to the market, we're 50 miles offshore, that transportation there is less. So it's more difficult for us to entice a supplier because of the additional upfront capital costs and then the annual operating costs. And then when we looked at the economic value between open loop, the open rack vaporizers, and burning 1 to 2% of our liquefied natural gas, our gas, there is a difference in economics there. And then we also looked at environmental. I'm an environmental professional. I've been an environmental professional for 25 years. So that also weighed into our decision to go with the seawater for warming the gas. And I'm seeing some people say, well, what is this? There's more than just biology and in environmental. So we looked at the actual burning of the gas offshore, greenhouse gas and air emissions. Yes, it is not much, but that also gas could have been used onshore. It's the amount of natural gas that will supply natural gas to a city of over 100,000 daily. So we're taking and we're using a resource offshore instead of bringing it onshore where it could be used onshore. So there's the economics there too, that loss.
Did I understand you to say that the amount of gas used to heat the LNG would be the equivalent of that required to power a city of 100,000 people?
On a daily basis, yes, sir.
That's just the amount that you use to heat the gas, to heat it in an open loop system.
No, in a closed loop system.
In a closed loop.
Yes.
And so that's an obvious savings, but you also said that ConocoPhillips, who I believe is a very fine corporate citizen, I live in Houston, and so I'm familiar with them, and I think they're very good citizens. You said that they had pledged that they would convert this open loop system to a closed loop in the event that the environmental impacts were greater than acceptable.
Absolutely.
What's the capital cost of that?
It's significant. I don't believe as a company we would have promised that. We have created that language, and we've asked that language be put in our compass port, which is offshore Alabama. We're setting the bar very high for offshore Alabama, which means we'd have to do the same thing for Texas.
What's
agency or what standard, objective standard, would there be to determine that that impact had exceeded the ability to mitigate? I mean, what would be the triggering mechanism to make this incredible conversion that of capital costs there? Because it's not, you know, seems to me like a very long lawsuit more than a...
We've promised to continue the monitoring. I told you Compassport in October 2004, we started on-site, site-specific data collection. We've promised to continue that. We would work with the National...
I'm sorry, you're not going to, who would do it? Where would the decision be made that triggers you've got to do it?
Right. It's in the license. It would be the National Marine Fisheries. And the data would go to them, and they would make the call.
I reiterate, listen to Sylvia Earle.
Well, we've got to, I think everyone agrees that we've got a lot to learn. We've got a lot to learn about this.
I think you got a good idea of the complexity of all these issues. And I do want to make clear the point that the examples and numbers I was using, I didn't necessarily know that the ConocoPhillips was going to be here today, and I didn't want to talk about a particular project. I had not pulled numbers out of their project just broadly, so I don't want to, for the plus or minuses, I don't want them to be attributed particular numbers, because I didn't do that.
Well,
but you got an idea.
Clearly, it's economic to do both closed loop and open loop, because you've got both. It's just, you know, the question is,
you've got nine closed loops already on the Texas shore, or either proposed or in some stage, and you know those people couldn't make money, and they figured out how they could do it with a closed loop.
Well, I think you make a point, and you should help me with this. Did I understand you to say that open rack offshore is not even competitive with onshore closed loop? Is that right? Because of the, I'm sorry, it says for Joy, because of the additional cost of offshore?
Again, it would depend on the distance.
Okay.
Because, you know, further offshore, the longer the pipeline, the more capital cost, distance to market.
Right.
Okay. I have one more question, Ms. Miley. Given that the capital cost to build offshore is double. Is that what I understood?
Yes.
And given that you have a 50-mile distance to get back onshore to where the market is for the gas, would you in fact build a closed loop offshore? I mean, why would you build one offshore that costs twice as much and you have to transmit the gas 50 miles?
I personally don't know the answer to that question. We would have to look at it as a company to see if it's justified to change the technology. Oh, yeah.
Closed loop offshore does exist.
Well, there's only one offshore in operation in the world, and that's offshore Louisiana, and it's open loop.
I'm sorry. I thought you said there were 40 around the world.
Near shore.
Oh.
Onshore, nearshore.
So what does nearshore mean versus offshore? Does that mean it's
getting
in
water
the bay
within 2 to 3 miles of the coast? Withdrawing their water from within 2 to 3 miles of the coastline.
Okay, so the facility would be on land, and they would pipe the water in.
The gasification that occurs near shore. All right, one more time. I'm still trying to get my facts straight here. There is or is not an offshore closed-loop system operating? Start somewhere in the world.
No.
There's not anywhere in the world an offshore closed-loop.
That's correct, okay. But it is possible technology.
Commissioner Holmes, Commissioner Holmes, the nearshore ones you're talking about, you have to be careful when you call nearshore. Nearshore, here, for us, the water depths are 40 feet. Off Alaska, it can be 3,000 to 4,000 feet. So there's issues you have to deal with, and they're all different.
That's an important point you're saying, because the Gulf is shallow. Offshore doesn't mean the same thing in the Gulf that it means other places. It's still similar to nearshore. as far as debt.
I do want to conclude, you know, we have, obviously with all these facilities we're talking about here and the companies we're working with, of course we work very close with ExxonMobil on the inshore and ConocoPhillips here. And we have good working relationships with all those companies. Now, we may fundamentally disagree on how we approach things from the beginning because our agency is a fish and wildlife agency. We're looking at those issues. And we try to make sure that we deal with that. But we work with these companies regardless of what our general concerns are to try to get to some answer. And that's how
I think there's some consensus that if you could bring the Texas A&M Corpus Christi Heart Research Institute Gulf of Mexico Studies, your friend Wes Tunnel, Sylvia Earle, those sort of resources to brief us on not to say that these aren't independent reviews that we're getting today, but another opinion.
Well, you'd have to assume that they want to talk about it and get into this. Into this, I don't know if they will or not.
Well, they shouldn't have gotten into the Gulf of Mexico issue if they didn't want to deal with it. Because this one's coming.
Very good, sir. Thank you
for that briefing. And we do have a few more items we have to get done this morning.